I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome on this rainy Monday here in Baltimore, at any rate. My co-host for today, every Monday, is Anthony McCarthy. Anthony, welcome. Good to see you with us.
Great to see you after our Thanksgiving holiday.
I know, we're recovering from that. And before we I was going to turn this over to traffic, but computers are down, so we can't turn you over to traffic. So all I have to say is this. Drive slow, be polite, be careful, don't have any accidents. It'll all be very cool. So that's our traffic report for today. Anyway, so we're going to jump right into the show. We have our program today. We have a lot going on this next couple hours. We'll be talking with Rich Benjamin later about his book, Whitetopia. We'll be looking at the trial of Sheila Dixon later on with a lawyer, Dwight Pettit, and Melody Simmons, who's covering the trial for us. And the jury has been sent home to let you all know if you haven't already heard. And they only have one more day. Apparently, they say they're going to come back tomorrow, and a decision will be made. And, of course, we'll be covering that when that happens as we momentous for the city. And we have a lot to talk about with that beyond just the legal aspects of the trial, of course, the politics and social implications of all this for all of us and the larger political implications. So, but that's all coming. And right now we're going to have a conversation with Amy Goodman. Amy Goodman, of course, is the host of Democracy Now! She's here every day, Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. here on WEA, on stations around the country and around the globe on television and radio and on the Internet. And I was reading last night that she attempted to go across the border into Canada to an event that was planned. And at that event, she didn't get to the event because she was not allowed to cross the border. And I read what Dave Zirin, the author of the People Supports History of the United States, wrote about that. He'll be on Wednesday to talk about that for a little bit. But right now we're going to talk to Amy Goodman herself as she gets ready for an event in Washington, D.C. And Amy, welcome. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be with you, Mark. And let me just say, those directions you gave for travel and weather were very important because we're driving in the car right now in Washington, D.C. So we're being very, very careful just because you said to.
That's good.
Anyone in the area, Busboys and Poets, 7 o'clock over at 14th and V, will be doing an event. And, you know, that ties very much into what I was doing last Wednesday, which was the day before Thanksgiving, because folks were having turkey in this country, and I was on this rapid-fire book tour around the country. We thought, well, you know, we really can't do events here at that time, so why don't we head north, and instead of people having talkie, we'll talk turkey. So we head to Vancouver from Seattle, where we were. We'd just been at Seattle Town Hall, and then I did this event as travelers were racing to catch their planes for Thanksgiving on Wednesday. We had a book signing at Borders in the airport. They said they've never done this before, and catching people, you know, as they're racing off. But I have to say one thing about this. Mm-hmm. Here we were on one side of Borders. It's one of the largest borders in the United States at an airport. And on the other side of the aisle, the entryway, was this big display of Sarah Palin's books, you know, called Going Rogue. As we were sitting and I was signing, someone got a book, someone got another, Breaking the Sound Barrier, another. And I just have something to report to you. By the end of the few hours, it was Breaking the Sound Barrier 40, Sarah Palin, zero. Going rogue is going nowhere.
That's very funny.
That's there. So we go from Borders to the border, and we head to Vancouver. We did not, you know, it's about 6 o'clock at the border. We're going to do a talk at the Vancouver Public Library at 7. Hand in our passports. That's routine at the border. And then they flag us. They pull us over. Start going through the car, tell us to step inside at the Douglas border crossing. We do that, and then they call me up to the counter, the Border Patrol. You know, these are armed guards, and they say, we need your notes on what you're going to talk about tonight. I said, excuse me? We need your notes. Meanwhile, now we're seriously late. You know, we were just moseying along. We were going to be right on time. Now it's getting late, and worse than that, this is getting very serious. And I realized, you know, I was going nowhere unless I complied. I went out to the car, and I brought out a copy of the book, because that's really what I base the talks on, the column. Ironically, of course, called Breaking the Sound Barrier, as we're trying to go across the border. I hand them the book, and he says, I want the notes. I said, well, this really is essentially my notes. I said, I start with the last column, which is about Tommy Douglas, considered the greatest Canadian. That's right, Tommy Douglas was the premier of Saskatchewan, and in the early 60s, he pioneered the national health care system of Canada. And interestingly, his grandson is actor Kiefer Sutherland. Kiefer Sutherland's mom is the actress Shirley Douglas. His father, Donald Sutherland, his grandfather, was considered the greatest Canadian. He is the premier of Saskatchewan, Tommy Douglas.
I never knew that.
This is what I'm telling the Border Patrol at the Douglas Crossing. They are not satisfied. They say, what else are you talking about? I said, well, I'll talk about global economic meltdown. Meanwhile, one of the guards is taking down all the notes on what I'm saying. One is reading the book. I say, global economic meltdown. What else are you talking about? I said, well, global warming. What else are you talking about? And I thought this could be a trigger, but this is what I was talking about. It's a public talk. I said, you know, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. What else are you talking about? I said, well, that pretty much does it. And the border guard says, what about the Olympics? What about the Olympics? I said, you mean when President Obama went to Copenhagen to try to get the Olympics to Chicago? He said, you didn't get them. I said, I know we didn't get them. But, I mean, is this a reason to bar me from Canada? I'm not talking about that. I said, you mean the Brazil Olympics? No, the Olympics here in Canada in 2010. I said, no, I was not planning to talk about the Olympics. You were denying that you were going to talk about the Olympics? I wasn't going to talk about the Olympics. So you're saying you're not going to talk about... I mean, this went on and on. He was clearly not convinced, definitely thought I was lying. He was incredulous. He told me to sit down, and they went out, and they went through the car with a fine-tooth comb. When I went out to check on them, I mean, I was very disturbed at this point. It was pouring rain. They're going through the car. He's on one of my colleagues' computers, you know, as if it's his own. They're going through everything. Finally, they come back in, and they say, I had to follow them into a small room in this sort of hangar-like facility. I go in the back. They take my picture, make four copies of the picture, and they staple a document into my passport, as well as my colleagues, my editor, Dennis Moynihan, the editor of the book, his passport, as well as the third person we were traveling. And I said, I'm confused. I didn't think we need a visa to enter Canada. They said, these are not visas. These are control documents. I open it. It says we're to leave 2 days later, Friday, right, the day after. And we're there for the 25th, 27th. And, you know, hours, we make our way to Vancouver and to the public library. But I'll tell you something. The board guards my interest. What is it about the succession with the Olympics that will be taking place in Canada? This was, to say the least, unsettling, very disturbing. I felt violated personally, professionally as a journalist, and for my whole profession, journalism. This is not only a violation of freedom of the press. I mean, you know, here you have, we can have sensitive documents, sources. The state is not supposed to be going through our papers. It's not as if they had some kind of warrant. It's not only, though, a violation of freedom of the press, a violation of the public's right to know. Because if journalists are afraid to do their work, that they'll be monitored, surveilled, detained, that their documents, that their computers can be gone, then the public is going to get less information. And that is a threat to a democratic society. It's not good for a democracy. We need to make our, we have to be able to do the work that serves a democratic society.
It's interesting to me that, and I was after also reading what David Zirin was writing, that the Canadian government is so politically sensitive about these Vancouver Olympics and how they're kind of really nailing down opposition and holding people back from saying what they think, and it's pretty onerous. And I heard what you did in your show this morning briefly about what happened to you in the Canadian Olympics. So. And that they thought you were going to talk about it, and you were somehow going to slam Canada.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's very significant what's going on there. Of course, once we got there, I started to see and understand. You know, my detention became the top story in Canada. It was crazy. CBC News, 6 o'clock, you know, journalist detained for fear that she would address the Olympics. And right after the interview that they did with me, this is on TV, on radio, they had a piece on the Vancouver City Council on how it's being forced to amend a legislation that they recently passed, where if you even have I think an anti-Olympic sign in your house. They can raid your house. If you're not allowed to carry anti-Olympic signs in downtown, in the area near the Olympics. And then I saw one of the spokespeople saying the reason this is important is to protect taxpayers, because if corporations feel there'll be anti-Olympic fervor, they won't advertise, and that will hurt the taxpayers. So actually they're saying it's not about, you know, democracy. It's about the financial base. I think when you do things like this, when you make dissent unsafe, I think that threatens national security of a country. And clearly Canadians do, because they're getting a lot of pushback, everything from the fear that Vancouver will be bankrupt to what's going to happen to the homeless people, who's going to be moved. The whole issue of civil liberties is very much in the forefront of the people of Canada right now.
Amy, this is Anthony McCarthy.
Hi, Anthony.
How are you? I'm very curious at how our government has responded to this. I listened to the show this morning. I was reading some stuff online. I'm very curious. An American journalist detained at a border, and specifically not over some threat, but over free speech when it comes to the Olympics.
That's right. Well, it's very serious. And I don't know what the response of the U.S. government right now is, but it is a serious violation.
Most definitely.
All of us.
Maybe they thought you were working with David Colbert.
Well, they certainly, you know, we certainly weren't planning to talk about the Olympics, and I won't say the state determines what we do on Democracy Now. We are a free and open press, but I have to say there is a reason that we did this whole story this morning on Democracy Now. I mean, in a sense, the Border Patrol, I guess, did lead to that story because they engaged in this kind of crackdown. And of course, I'm more public, so you know about this. What about all the people that aren't?
I know it also says to me something about the increased corporatization of our political world, that's so involved not just in American politics, Canadian politics, the politics of many nations, that they do see this as opposed to their economic interests are completely intertwined with their political interests. And I'm not surprised, the more I read about what happened to you, but what Dave Zirin was writing, that this in fact is taking place. It's a threat.
Yeah, it's a very serious issue, and this issue of the Olympics and the whole history of their increasing commercialization and what they've come to represent and cracking down on those that would raise any issue with them is a serious one. There was a whole movement in Chicago actually not to have the Olympics come to Chicago.
Right.
Also on that issue, I actually had President Obama's trip to Copenhagen on my mind very much. I mention it in every trip, the one where he pushed for the Olympics to come to Chicago, because until very recently, he had not signaled that he'd be going to Copenhagen for the climate change talks, only a slightly more important event, some call it the most important diplomatic event in history, this gathering to deal with climate change, than him pushing for the Olympics. And it really matters that he said he was going to go, but it's deeply troubling that he said that there will be no binding treaty that comes out of this, that the Senate hasn't passed any legislation around global warming, and I dare say it's quite linked to the fact that, among others, the oil, gas, and coal companies have poured something like $300,000 a day into lobbying against any kind of climate change legislation. And this is just unacceptable. I mean, these issues cut across the political spectrum. They affect us all. And they cannot be simply determined by the level of corporate financing that goes into lobbying. Like, look at the insurance industry, the whole healthcare debate in our country. The insurance industry, Big Pharma, are pouring in more than $1.4 million a day into lobbying Congress. Is it any surprise that the bills they come out with, while yes, they will insure millions more people who didn't have insurance, and that's a good thing, the fact that now these insurance industries are going to get more money than they've ever gotten in their history, and that is saying a tremendous amount. And that the White House and the U.S. government has negotiated with Big Pharma, with the drug companies, to pay them enormous sums instead of, if you're negotiating and buying in bulk, you would have to pay less. It is astounding what these corporations have accomplished. The effect of money in politics in this country just goes to the whole issue of why we need campaign reform and campaign finance reform in this country.
Well, you know, it made me think, let me open the phones for a few minutes before you have to go, Amy, at 410-319-8888. We're talking with the host of Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, my co-host Anthony McCarthy here on Monday as usual. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com or log on to the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page and we'll read your comments there as well. And Gary, you're on the air.
I just couldn't believe it when I turned on the radio and Amy was on with you, Mark, and Anthony. And, you know, I just came out of a store in Walbrook Junction. I'm a Baltimore City fireman. I have on my Democracy Now! Hoodie.
All right.
Nice.
This morning. Amy,
I wish I had mine on right now.
I was getting ready to come to D.C. after I got off from work today, but I said, you might think I'm stalking you or something.
You got to come. 7 o'clock, there's still time. I might come over there. 14th and V.
I used to be the hostess cake man over on 14th Street back in the early 80s, but I just wanted
I want to say one thing before you ask your question. I think it's very interesting you're a Baltimore City fireman, because one of the things around the issue of health care and the outrage of the lack of debate in the mainstream media and why Mark's show is so important, why WEAA is so important, why independent media in general is so important, is that you look at the how constrained the debate is. I mean, when most people in this country are polled and are asked what they think of what we should have, when explained, it's single payer. It's such a simple concept, except the corporate media almost never expresses it.
Right.
Even if you have an 8-second soundbite, I mean, 1-1,000, 2-1,000, 3-1,000, can you say it certainly faster than you can describe these 1,000-page bills you get in Congress? It's very simple. You drop the age of eligibility of Medicare to the day you're born. Right? Everyone understands that. It is so easy, and I said that in less than 5 seconds. I'm ready for prime time. The idea is not, and that's why they don't include it. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting did this study, fair.org, of the week leading up to Obama's White House healthcare summit last March, and they looked at the major networks and the major national newspapers. In that week leading up, there was not one major spokesperson for single payer. It was only mentioned to be criticized. Now, the reason your profession inspired me to think about all this is because so often you'll hear the allegation, oh, you want this country going socialist, you know, health care for all. Do we say that about the U.S. military? It's socialist. Do we say it about...
Well, we have to continue to be radicals, and to be a radical
I want to get to the core of the truth.
And it's so propitious that I talked to a French-Canadian firefighter just yesterday. He was down here for the Ravens-Steelers game. A friend of mine in Canada named Francois. So I'm going to make sure I get into contact with him and my French-Canadian fellow firefighters and, you know, and just remind them that the Montreal 76 Olympics just got paid off recently. People think folks make a lot of money on the Olympics, and they're basically a loss for the not the status quo. They're a loss for the people. And basically, Ralph, but I'll find out about things like this is on Democracy Now! And Grit TV, the Mark Steiner Show, from Anthony McCarthy. But I simply must say this quickly. I saw you with Kwame Abeyomi on Evanston Avenue years ago. He introduced you as a prophet, Amy. I saw you at St. Peter Clavern.
Clavern.
I saw you at Morgan State with when Mark Steiner introduced you, and I just recently saw you at MICA. And I simply want to tell you to continue on. Your mother is with us. My mother is with us. And I know other people want to talk to you. So in the interest of time, I'll leave you. But I want you to know that you have a soldier here in the Baltimore City Fire Department.
Thank you.
Well, Gary, thank you so much. And thank you for doing what you do. And one of the bravest jobs in our society is people who fight our fires. Amy, I'd like to try to get a couple of callers here before it's time to go, if that's okay. 410-319-8888, Kwame, in your car, you're on the air.
Well, Mark and Amy and Anthony, this is Dr. Kwame Abeyomi. I was so glad to hear my name mentioned.
Oh, that's very funny.
Former caller. and I just had to call when I heard Amy's show this morning and now the reverb on it this afternoon. I simply wanted to say, when we look at the growing number of behaviors of government that you have cataloged, Amy. Your incident at the border in Canada, we look at the overwhelming influence of the corporate dollar on political activity and particularly government legislation. I want to scream the word fascism, because literally what we have in a widespread behavior pattern is nothing but fascist behavior by our government. I mean, this whole idea that the president's getting ready to announce sending more troops to end the war, I find it bereft of common sense, and I find it almost insulting when we consider that he promised or he made commitments to do just the opposite during his campaign. I hate to be the Chicken Little of today, but I want to say that this is indeed growing fascist tendency and behavior by our government, and certainly nothing less than that was what occurred at the border with you, sustained me over the weekend. Mark, Anthony, and Amy, I wish you all Godspeed.
Kwame, always good to hear from you. What were you going to say, Amy?
It's great to hear your voice, and this issue of the escalation of war that President Obama will be announcing tomorrow night is extremely serious, and the supreme irony that, you know, he announces the escalation and the tens of thousands of troops, more troops that will be sent there just before he heads to Oslo to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. And at the same time that he announces this escalation of troops, this whole controversy at the State Department is brewing around a State Department spokesperson saying that they've completed a review on the landmine ban treaty and they will not sign it. This is shock. Sent the human rights community reeling. Really a major issue in the world right now. You know, when Princess Di at the end of her life, this was the issue of her life, is to get rid of landmines, not to mention of many human rights activists and Nobel Peace Prize winners, etc. And here is the U.S. government saying that they will not sign on to this. This has shocked many people. But I don't think it's up to one person in the White House. I do think that for years people have felt that they've been hitting their heads against a brick wall. And that wall has become a door. The door is open, a crack. And the question is, will people kick it open or it will be slammed shut? That's up to everyone.
I wonder, Amy, if in terms of what we've just been talking about, that I was reading over the weekend that Glenn Beck, the conservative right-wing host on Fox and on radio, is going around the country to organize town meetings, because what he's saying is that he wants to organize a groundswell of people into a movement from all of his listeners. And someone said about who you're going to support for president, and his response was, our job is not to create, it's not to see who's going to be for president, but have the president will come out of this movement. And I think that sometimes it feels as if, I mean, all these progressive forces in America kind of align themselves around Barack Obama's campaign, was really enthralled by the campaign, people of color, young people, poor people, students, and people just kind of, in a wave, progressives pushed him over the top. And people expected certain things in terms of what you were talking about, in terms of the corporate power in D.C. and how that was going to be challenged, and the war in Afghanistan and the right to a public option or a single payer system. And so clearly you're not going to go to Glenn Beck's rallies, but I mean, it seems to me that there's not the opposite power lurching from the other side.
I think that people are sort of off balance. There are so many millions of people who hadn't voted before or who had voted but were deeply concerned that there wasn't true representation of their views. And now that the person they voted for is, what they were for, the peace movement, the environmental movement, they're not seeing their issues addressed in the way that they want them addressed. But people have to realize the community organizer-in-chief has become the commander-in-chief. And now it's up to people in their communities to do the community organizing. I mean, the good thing is that parents all over this country now will say to their kids, maybe you can be a community organizer too. But the real issue here is that those who are used to walking the halls of, you know, the corridors of power in Washington still walk. The cocoon around the president is still woven by those who've enjoyed power for years, whether it's the coal companies, whether it's the weapons manufacturers, whether it's the folks from Goldman Sachs that he brings in to determine economic policy, and they bail out to the tune of trillions these financial institutions that can most afford it. And the money comes from those that least can afford it, you know, the taxpayers of this country. So he's surrounded. Those who are used to whispering in the ear of the most powerful person on earth their demands, they still do it. But if he can't point out the window of the Oval Office and say, if I do that, they will storm the Bastille, if there's no one out there, he's in big trouble. And if there's times that people feel, no, I'm totally opposed to what he's representing, they have to figure out what to do. What to do with the person they may well have voted for, and how to take on these issues and not look at it as a person-centered campaign, but as an issue-centered campaign. But on that note, I'm going to have to leave you guys.
Yes, you do.
We have to walk into the talk, and I thank you. So, and
thank you, Amy.
Break the sound barrier once again right here in Washington, D.C.
Busboy and Poets at 7 o'clock, correct?
Yes, Busboys and Poets at 7 o'clock. And if your local newspaper wants to run the weekly column, which is called Breaking the Sound Barrier, they're welcome to do that. They can check out our website at
busboysandpoets.org. Thanks. Take care, Amy. Thank you so much.
And looking to join folks tomorrow morning at 8. Thanks, Mark.
Looking forward to it. Bye-bye. Thank you, Amy.
Bye-bye.
And all of you listening to our program here in Prince George's County, Montgomery County, Washington, D.C., and the environs, going over to Busboy and Poets at 7 o'clock tonight. And
14th and V.
14th and V. I know it to you. That's,
yeah.
That's a good place. Good place.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony McCarthy and I are going to come back, and when we do come back from the break, we're going to be talking with Richard Benjamin, who's the author of Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey into the Heart of White America, part of the OSI Baltimore series on race. He'll be here tomorrow night live at Enoch Pratt. Be here tonight to talk about that and more. So stay with us for that part of the conversation. Urbanite Radio Stories on the Mark Steiner Show are made possible by Connections Academy, an accredited online private school with affordable tuition for grades K through 12. Visit nationalconnectionsacademy.com. For more information, we'll be right back with Richard Benjamin. Stay with us. I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back here with my co-host, Anthony McCarthy. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. Anthony McCarthy, every Monday evening, co-hosts this program with me. His own program is on every Friday in this time slot between 5 and 7 p.m., the Anthony McCarthy Show. He's with me every Monday. It's always a pleasure to have Anthony in the studio.
Always great to be with you, Mark.
For the next section of our program, before we talk about the trial of Mayor Sheila Dixon, and seems to be maybe winding down, maybe not. We'll talk about that with a few of our experts in a little bit. We're going to talk with Richard Benjamin, who wrote the book Whitetopia. And it's an amazing book, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. He will be here tomorrow night with Tim Wise, who wrote the book Between Barack and a Hard Place, Racism and White Denial in the Age of Obama. They're going to discuss white America's struggle to talk about race, as it's the fifth in the series of the Open Society Institute Baltimore's year-long series. It'll take place tomorrow night at 7 p.m., December the 1st, at Enoch Pratt Library in the Wheeler Auditorium. It's free. And we encourage you to get down early to get a seat. This auditorium's full up. A lot of people come to these events, which shows how much people do want to talk about the issue of race in our country and in our society. And Rich Benjamin has done a really remarkable thing as an African-American man, a senior fellow at Demos think tank in Washington and in New York City, who made a 26,000-mile journey around the United States, spent months in different locations, and locations that if you're African-American, you might think twice about when to spend some time in, but he did. In New York City as well, but I don't mean New York City. In places like Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and in Oregon and other places, we'll talk about that and more. And Richard Benjamin, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. 410-319-8888 is the number here. This is really a remarkable journey that you took. And as a black man in America, to make this journey through the heart of really white America, I mean, we have to know first what spurred you on to this journey.
Well, I had been hearing on the ground buzz, you know, reports from white people I know that people they know had been moving to places like Bend, Oregon, and Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and St. George, Utah. And I had to figure out what was going on. Is this a big trend? So I looked at the numbers, and in fact, there are growing numbers of white Americans moving to these communities that I call Whitetopia. So I didn't just want to write about these places without getting a real, real sense of what they're like. So I embedded myself in them for 2 years.
And you literally did. And there's that word of the 21st century, embedded. But you did, though. I mean, you sent, if I have this right, you spent 3 months or months living in three of those places, in Utah, in St. George, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and in Forsyth County, Georgia, which is the mostly white county surrounding Atlanta, correct?
Yes.
Now that, in a broad sense, and I really can't wait to get to the heart of all the stuff you wrote about here and some of the people you met, but one of the things, like when you're sitting in the bar in Idaho,
mm-hmm.
and having a drink, what was his name? Why am I blocking his name? The young guy.
Stan.
23 years old. And then you're going off fishing, and he says to you things like, oh, you know what? He says some of how colored people feel, and you say, I prefer the word black. And he says, well, I'm not sure what you people really want, and when I'm with my friends, I just use the N-word.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. That happened in Utah,
excuse me.
In a community called Utah. We were fishing, and, you know, I had befriended these folks, and I got to know about their community, and we're fishing. And then he said, you know, what are we calling you people this month? You people referring to black people. And I said, always black. You know, I don't use the word African-American. I say always black. He said, well, you know, I never know what to call you. So when I'm in white company only, I just use the N-word. And he was half joking, half not.
I'm sure half not. And I think here's what struck me about this. And I just want to kind of explore this a bit, because you talk about, in the overarching sense, the racism that we individuals have and the whole idea of structural racism,
mm-hmm.
Or interpersonal racism and structural racism. And one of the things, and I know so many, how can I put this? I just may put it this way. I know so many really decent, hardworking white Americans,
mm-hmm.
who are very conservative, and I know very racist, mm-hmm. in their own feelings, but also very open and warm human beings who would help anybody no matter who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
But you kind of touched the heart of that contradiction.
I do. I think in this day and age, racism prompts a lot of cognitive dissonance. And by that I mean, as you point out, we have a lot of nice, kind, endearing folks in this country of all races, including whites. And I experienced this firsthand. When you're in a pickle, when you're in a bind, they will help you, and they welcome you to their homes.
Mm-hmm.
The contradiction is these people will not bat an eyelash and are perfectly comfortable with the growing racial and economic segregation that is vexing our country. And so on the one hand, I think this country should pat itself on the back on the enormous racial progress we've made since my parents' generation, you know, which is the 1960s. On the other hand, we're still as segregated as a country today as we were in 1970, which was before I was even born. So that's the contradiction. We have nice, endearing people on one hand, and we have these entrenched inequality on another.
Mm. Richard, this is Anthony McCarthy. I experience this all the time. When I grew up in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, and my high school, maybe 600, 800 students, there were maybe 15 to 20 African Americans, 20 blacks at the most. And my closest friends were white. I would go to their home, and somehow, inevitably, it would come out where they would say, or their parents would be like, this is the first time a black person's ever been in our home.
All right.
Or these people treated me so incredibly well. I would have these deep personal relationships with them. And then I would take some friends from Baltimore back home. And when we would come back to Baltimore, they'd say, never take me there again.
Black friends.
Black friends would say, Anthony, that guy, he was a redneck or he was a racist. And I'd say, wait a minute, that's one of the warmest human beings. But then when I would study their language, when I would really hear what they were saying, yeah, they were racist. But it's amazing how absolutely warm they were. They paid for some of my college education. They pushed me through. They gave me opportunities even when I was growing up in the Shenandoah Valley. America has come far. But boy, we have far to go. And how quickly those of us people of color are stunned sometimes by the racism that's around us that we've grown accustomed to or, I guess, comfortable with.
Yes. And the question now becomes, okay, moving forward, we want to put our best foot forward as a country. We want to make progress on everybody's behalf and have the best America we can. Does the sort of touchy-feely personal aspect of race, you know, are we getting along? Are we kind? Are we warm and fuzzy? Is that what we want to focus on? Or do we want to focus on resources and power and neighborhoods and schools and how things shake out along racial lines? And part of my point is that, you know, good feelings and good manners aren't a bad thing. Like, that's a good thing to have on your day-to-day life. But what about the other aspects of how we run this country?
Did you find, Richard, that when you visited some of these areas, I did a story when I was a young reporter about Forsyth County, Georgia. Did you find that when you asked these deep questions about going further, about institutional racism, about health care, about poverty, did you find that whites were comfortable making that distinction? You know what? I care about those issues, but that's not our issue. Being a good person, I treat everybody with respect. That was important to them.
Yes, I did find that, and even in the South. And in fairness to extremely conservative white Americans, in fairness to them, not only are they comfortable with huge gaps across racial lines, they're often comfortable with huge gaps within their own family.
Class.
So, you know, if Aunt May and Aunt Bessie are living in poverty and they're making a big amount of money, they're comfortable. So it's almost a philosophical comfort with inequality, and that if it shakes along racial lines, as it really does in big pockets of this country, they're fine with that. So I guess the answer to your question is, yes, I did find many people, A, who aren't aware of that, B, who are in sort of like comfortable neglect, and C, who know about the inequality but are perfectly comfortable with it.
410-319-8888 is number here to join this conversation. Anthony McCarthy's on the air with me, but that's not what we're talking about. Talking about Rich Benjamin and his book, and Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. Tomorrow night at 7 p.m., he'll be taking part in the fifth in this series of Talking About Race. He'll be talking with Tim Wise, who's the author of the book Between Barack and a Hard Place, Racism and White Denial in the Age of Obama, at 7 o'clock tomorrow night at Enoch Pratt Central Branch, part of the ongoing series of Open Society Institute Baltimore. And there are conversations about race in our community, which really have been well attended. Encourage you all to get down there as early as you humanly can. But join us here now at 410-319-8888 for a sneak preview and a conversation with Rich Benjamin, author of Searching for Whitetopia. Going back to this, the book for a minute, as we get ready to go to open the phones here, as I was finishing the book, I started thinking about where we really do go from here with this, because this is not, it's not when I was young, and I feel terrible now because I'm like I'm old enough to be your father, but that when we were in the civil rights movement and kind of fighting against segregation, so I mean, very clear. But what you see now is a mixture, as you write about in the book, a mixture of class and race.
Yeah.
As you write about the separations between white working class and white poor people and the white upper classes, and class is very much a part of it, and it gets all confused because on one hand, it reminds me of back in the early, late 60s on the border of Mississippi and Alabama, where they broke a union apart of pulp workers when I was down there, and between white and black. And the wives got together, white and black women, and brought the union together, and they won the battle. But right. We're talking about situations. You know, so this is a very It's such a, I think it's so confusing. People not sure how to put their hands around this question at the moment.
It's a huge question. And one of the things that's gratifying to me is when I looked on a ranking, books about race, books about class, this has a higher rank as a book about class than a book about race.
I think so. Yeah.
The book is essentially, I thought I was traveling America 27,000 miles to write a book about race. In essence, I've written a book about class. Mm-hmm. And even in all white communities, you have these terrible class divides. For example, in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, in the early part of the day, I had been hanging out with Ed, this guy I had befriended, only to learn 2 weeks later that he's living out of a rented storage unit because he can't afford an apartment or a house in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. That very afternoon, I went to the sprawling estate mm-hmm. of Shelley and Ron, who are these cattle barons and real estate barons, and they had U.S. Senator Mike Crapo of Idaho there, and he's promising the crowd more tax relief. And so in homogenous white communities, you still have class divides that we're grappling with. And a lot of this flight, a lot of how we live in neighborhoods, it has to do with class as much as race.
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. A lot of people calling in as we were talking with Rich Benjamin about his book, Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page and join the conversation there. And Donnie in West Baltimore, you're on the air.
How you doing, Mark?
Hi, Donnie. Welcome.
Hey, Donnie.
It's very interesting to hear Richard talk about race and class. I've often alluded on our radio show how slavery was more about money and capital than it was race. Race was more so the subterfuge. But my question for Richard mm-hmm. is, in your research, did you find that these wealthy or upwardly mobile white Americans were aware of where wealth comes from, namely free African labor and free African resources?
Interesting.
It's funny. All across America, we have, we're not a historical country. We don't think in historical terms. So white, black, yellow, purple, when you talk about history, people kind of draw a blank face. So to say, oh, your money derives from, you know, slave labor, or your house derives from XYZ, oftentimes that's not a useful angle from my perspective, because we as a country generally don't like to think about history. And so their people's eyes glaze over, no matter whether they're racist or not. And so, no, the answer to the listener's question is no. I don't dwell on the history of slavery. There is enough, trust me, plenty to talk about how money is earned and not earned in this country than to have to go back 40 years. You know, I don't have an opinion on, you know, slavery going back 40 years. But I'm saying we could talk about the here and now without having to go back 40, 60, 100 years.
Richard, we have a lot of callers who probably want to jump in, but I want to ask you about faith for a moment, about religion.
Yeah.
Is it pretty much across the board Protestant? I mean, I think we have a real – those of us who consider ourselves to be so well-educated, so well-traveled, well-read. But when you visit the communities that you visited in your book, Searching for Whitetopia, pretty much across the board, they share a pretty common faith, right?
For the most part, except for St. George, Utah, which is about 65% Mormon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was just curious about that.
The religious differences are fascinating. So in St. George, Utah, it's very Mormon. It's about 65% Mormon and 35% Protestant. And one day I'm driving around St. George, Utah. I see a long line snaking in a strip mm-hmm. mall. I said, "What's that?" They said, "That's the county's only bar." So a county of 150,000 people only had one liquor store.
Mm-hmm.
So that's tends to be Mormon. Now, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho is Protestant with some Mormons, and it has a very libertarian streak.
Yeah.
So it's not very, very religious.
Yeah.
And Forsyth County, Georgia is very Baptist. And so I went to mega churches. I went to Baptist communions and got to learn about the community that way.
You spent your time in mostly white churches in this journey.
Yes, all white churches.
All white churches, I mean to say, right?
Not a single synagogue or black church.
How were you received by young people? And by young people, I mean teenagers. We always say that young people are so different from their previous generation.
Yeah. I don't believe on social beliefs such as race, and those type, and mm-hmm. inequality in class, that they're all that different from their parents. I had a fun with the young folks. The young folks, you know, we played volleyball, we played pickup basketball, uh-huh. we played poker together. I felt warmly received, and I felt they were very hospitable. And what fascinates me about some pockets of these young people are untouched by the mass culture that the rest of young Americans are living in. And by that I mean certain sports culture, hip-hop culture. One young guy had never seen a rap video.
Wow.
And so I had interesting, you know, conversations with these young folks. Some of these young folks were extremely conservative. Some were Mike Huckabee supporters.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying, you know, Rich, we're praying for some godly, wise leadership for America.
Let's return to the phones at 410-319-8888. A lot of people calling in and waiting on the line here to talk with Rich Benjamin, author of the book Searching for Whitetopia and a Probable Journey to the Heart of White America. He will be tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Part of the conversation on OSI's Conversational Race at Enoch Pratt Library at 7 p.m. downtown. And Tim and Waverly are on the air.
Hello, Mark, and I'll be there tomorrow night. Short anecdote, I go back 40 years with Mark to the ages of 16 through 18 when he was a street club worker, and quite often those of us in the white burbs were the only people that had been in many of the black families' neighborhoods and houses. I also tutored with Chester Wickwire, where I know I was the only people on Pennsylvania Avenue to walk into a lot
only
of
white people
houses.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And my question is, when I am attacked for being a white person in a black neighborhood where I live now, east of Greenmount, why is this not racism? I've been told by sociologists that if blacks have had historically and even currently no real systemic institutional power, that they thereby cannot be racist. And I'll take the answer off the air. I'll turn the radio back on.
Tim.
Love you, Mark.
Thank you so much, Tim. Interesting question, Richard, and one often debated.
Sociologists put forth that argument that the caller just mentioned, that when people don't have power, they're not capable of racism. And I think that's hogwash. I think that's nonsense. I think every race is capable of racism with differing impacts. Having said that, I don't really engage when groups do this, you know, discrimination Olympics. You know, you did this to me, I did this to you. Who's the bigger victim of racism? Hopefully, the book has this optimistic tone where we say this country is changing rapidly and dramatically. How do we go forward? And it points out in the conclusion, this is what people of color might consider to do if we want this better country of ours. And so one of the answer is not to say, oh, you know, black people are not capable of racism because we have less power than white people. In sociology, I've heard that argument he's made, and it's popular in some circles.
But not in your circle of one. Or more,
yeah,
maybe.
Right.
More, just, not in your circles, what I mean to say.
Do the host buy that argument?
I believe that racial hatred can stem from any place. You know, I got an email last night from a friend of mine. I'm going to go down to the Hopi Reservation in March and visit some people. And he was saying how, talking about the hatred that exists between Hopis and Navajos, and how one woman's husband said, he can't use the word Hopi without expletives and the word liar in front of it.
Hmm.
And
wow.
You know what I'm saying? The divisions are very deep. And I think that the argument that it's hard to practice racism unless you're in power does not mean you cannot be a racist in your everyday actions. That's how I look at it.
Okay.
And I agree. I mean, I think it all stems from the place where you have the power to engage in this. And I think that black people can be racist. I think black people can be classist. I think that the power base may be different and their impact to act out their racism can be different. But yeah, I don't buy the argument that we don't have, I'm African American, we don't have the power or we're not racist. I've met many African American, I've met many black racists.
And part of what, I'll open the phones here, but part of when I get the conversation, before we end the conversation after the top of the hour, I want to kind of really kind of explore where we go from here and the experiences you've had. I mean, because I think that your experiences are very intense in what you've learned. And we just lost three callers in a row who are tired of waiting and hearing us talk. Let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. And Norman, if you call back, I'll get you right on the air. Mike, and you're on the air. Mike, you're on the air. Can we get Mike on the air?
Yeah, we got him finally.
Go ahead. You're there, man. Go ahead.
Good to be here. I'd like to talk about the connection between race and class in the history of this country. And first of all, I strongly disassociate myself from this treating of race as simply a moral category. Our history proves that race and class are, on the one hand, inextricably connected throughout American history. They're inseparable. On the other hand, exploitation produces profit if you're exploiting black labor, if you're exploiting white labor, or any ethnicity. Exploitation produces profit. The way we're going to solve this problem is by uniting blacks and whites. If you can't deal with that, you're a part of a problem and not the solution. We have to unite poor whites and poor blacks to make a better world. Like it or not, that's the path to social progress.
Rich, what do you think about that?
Well, here's the complicated part. I write in this book, this is not about black-whites relation. The biggest minority in this country is Latinos. So I completely agree with the sentiment of what the caller said. Yes, working people in this country have common interests. Now, what happens when these working people are not Americans? Then in many of these communities, things, you know, the tensions start flaring. And so I don't think just because people are Latino, obviously they shouldn't be included in labor rights. But I'm just saying it's more complicated than the color implies, because now we have this population. Forget about white and black. What about brown?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to explain it a tad further, but as I said, promise, we're going to go right back to the phones, 410-319-8888. Norman, you're on the air. Hi, Norman, you're on the air.
I'm here. Okay. How you doing?
Well, welcome.
All right. I wanted to talk to the author about race. The notion that he did a book on, tried to do a book on race and ended up doing a book on class, but he mentioned something about like the ability of a black person to be racist. And I guess my comment is, maybe we're using the wrong term when it comes to racism, because whatever the situation is where you, through your racial hatred, have the opportunity to deny people access to all the institutions in the country, like businesses, schools, the government. If we're going to say, like, I'm of the belief that black people cannot be racist because we don't have the power to act upon it, act upon our racial hatred. In other words, we don't have the ability to deny people access to the courts and deny people access to the government and businesses. And that. We don't have what is the terminology we should use for the people who have the power to deny people access to all of these things?
Well, that, Rich, is what we were talking about earlier. It really is a kind of classic definition of racism and why people argue that African Americans cannot be racist in America.
Well, I mean, look at Clarence Thomas. He has the power to deny plenty of people plenty of things.
And look at an Oprah Winfrey. I mean, I think that the argument made sense at one point in history in this country. But I think that we have made significant enough progress where that argument can be dismantled a little bit. And I'm not saying that, you know, I understand where people hold on to that definition of racism. I really do.
And I appreciate the caller's point that the power is unequal. Obviously, black people do not have the share of economic, legal, and political power that white people do. But we do have some power. And I would hope that black people would raise their kids in such a way that they didn't say, oh, throw up your hands, we don't have any power. Therefore, you can act out of control towards other races. Doesn't make sense to me.
And I think that, and I want to again reintroduce our guest to those who are just people just tuning in. Rich Benjamin is our guest for this part of our program. He's written the book Searching for Utopia, An Improbable Journey into the Heart of White America. Tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at the Enoch Pratt Library, he'll be taking part in the fifth dialogue on race put on by the Open Society Institute Baltimore. Tim Wise will be joining him there. He wrote the book Between Barack and a Hard Place, Racism and White Denial in the Age of Obama. He was going to join us tonight, too, but had a conflict with an event at his kid's school, so we know what takes a party there, and that's not a bad thing at all. The number here is 410-319-8888. And we have to take a break in about a minute. So I want Rowan, Alan, and Jay to please hold on. We're going to come to your calls after the top of the hour. So if you can bear with us, we're going to get to Alan first since he's been holding on the longest from Catonsville. And one of the things I want to explore as we come back to is talking to Rich Benjamin about, as a black man who went into Whitetopia, sat with regular white folks who are very conservative, many of whom are racist, not all of whom are, and to talk about where we take this from here and what he learned out of that experience, and this very complex world of race that we enter into now, which is not as simple as it was, in my day growing up or in my parents' day for clearly. The number is 410-319-8888 as we talk with Rich Benjamin. Can we go to break now or should we just, we're gonna take a quick break and come right back from this break and rejoin our conversation. So, Alan, and Roe and Jay in that order. We're going to come right back to your thoughts. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite looks at growing up in the city with a youth issue, featuring stories on child prodigies, the lives of teenagers, arrested adolescents, and how Baltimore can beat poverty by creating children's zones. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations. Visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com. For a list of drop locations, we'll be right back with Rich Benjamin.